at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Take care and be well.
This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Now more than 482,000 people have died globally from COVID-19, more than 121,000 in the United States. The number of confirmed infections exceeds 9.4 million globally, nearly 2.4 million in the U.S. Brazil figures continue to surge with nearly 54,000 deaths and approximately half the number of infections as the U.S. A coronavirus resurgence is wiping out 2 months of progress in the U.S. and sending infections to dire new levels in the South and West. Hospital administrators and health experts warned Wednesday that politicians and public tired of being cooped up or letting the disaster unfold. With more than 34,000 COVID-19 cases reported just Tuesday, the U.S. is back near its late April peak of 36,400. New cases have been declining steadily in the U.S. earlier in the hot spots like New York and New Jersey, but several other states have set single-day cases and records this week alone. They include Arizona, California, Mississippi, Nevada, and Texas. Some of them have also broke hospitalization records. Coronavirus infections are climbing rapidly among young Americans in a number of states where bars, stores, and restaurants have reopened. It's a disturbing generational shift that puts young people in greater peril than many realize and poses an even bigger danger to the older people who cross their paths. National figures show that almost as soon as states began reopening, people 18 to 49 years of age quickly became the age bracket most likely to be diagnosed with new cases. And also, although every age group saw an increase in cases during the first week in June, the number shot up fastest in the younger age group. This is VOA News. The International Monetary Fund believes the global economy will suffer more severe economic damage this year. In fact, the IMF sharply lowered its forecast for global growth as compared to 2 months ago. The IMF predicts that the global economy will shrink 4.9% this year, significantly worse than the 3% drop it had estimated in its previous report in April. It would be the worst recession in terms of global impact since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Qantas Airways has announced that it is releasing at least 20% of its workforce and plans to raise up to $1.9 billion of equity as part of a drastic measure in response to the coronavirus crisis. The Australian airline also said it will ground 100 aircraft for up to 12 months and some for longer, as well as retire its six remaining Boeing 747 jets immediately, 6 months ahead of schedule. Qantas said it will cut at least 6,000 positions among its 29,000 employees, while another 15,000 staff would remain stood down temporarily, particularly those associated with international operations, until more flying returns. Along with the other airlines around the world, Qantas is battling against a huge drop in demand after countries, including Australia, closed their borders to try to contain the global pandemic. Three white men arrested last month in the slaying of a black man who was gunned down as he jogged through a suburban neighborhood in Georgia 4 months ago were indicted on Wednesday on murder and other charges. Video footage showing the killing of 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery in the coastal southern Georgia town of Brunswick emerged on social media and went viral in May. It's about 10 weeks after his death, stoking public outrage at the lack of arrest at the time. Days later, two men seen confronting Arbery in the video, former police officer 64-year-old George McMichael and his son 34-year-old Travis McMichael, were taken into custody and charged with murder. 50-year-old William Roddy Bryan Jr., the man who videotaped the February 23rd shooting, was subsequently arrested and also charged with murder. On Wednesday, a grand jury returned a 9-count indictment against all three men, charging each defendant with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, and false imprisonment. According to a copy of the indictment, the three remain jailed without bond. U.S. House Democrats have blasted U.S. Attorney General William Barr at a hearing Wednesday over accusations he improperly meddled in criminal cases and antitrust probes for political gain. but they stopped short of pledging to take any steps to try and oust the nation's top law enforcement official. For iRemote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS's Community Court of Justice needs support to effectively carry out its mandate.
As it is now, three official languages in this court, and therefore at any point in time, there should be translation of all the court processes into the other two languages. In the same way, proceedings of this virtual court hearing is an IT issue, and therefore we will need about three more IT staff.
Africa seeks equitable access to any COVID-19 vaccine. South Africa struggles with second pandemic of violence against girls and women. Sickle cell patients in Cameroon ask for protection against COVID-19. And Malawi's ruling party accuses opposition of intimidating its supporters during Tuesday's voting.
As you are talking, Democratic Progressive Party monitors were abducted. Up to now, four girls and four boys are missing.
And Nigeria's fast-growing wedding industry struggles as marriages go virtual during the coronavirus pandemic. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. President of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS's Community Court of Justice, says the court needs support from member countries to be able to effectively carry out its mandate of protecting human rights. Justice Edward Moako Asante from Ghana says the coronavirus pandemic has forced the court to suspend in-person court proceedings and to resort to virtual sessions. He says the court needs more translators and IT specialists to sustain the new virtual court. The court was set up in 2003 to monitor human rights abuses in the region. Justice Asante expressed concern about the lack of enforcement of the court's judgments. The court held its first virtual news conference on Tuesday this week and also the first virtual court session on Monday. Justice Asante hopes the virtual court would help improve access to the court.
As you know, the pandemic has come to undo everything. Virtually, it's not possible, I don't think so, for people to do this physical court sitting anymore because of social distancing. You know, in our parts of the world, people want to come to court to listen to cases. Everybody, whether people who have kids or not, their families follow them to court, and the court room cannot accommodate all these numbers, social distancing, and then the kind of contacts that people may have. And therefore, this one is much easier in our courtroom. Just about the three panels of judges, three sitting there and about two court clerks there in the register, about six or seven people in the courtroom. And the lawyers and their clients also stay in their countries and assess the court. So basically, I think it's very good and far, far cheaper because they don't have to travel to Abuja, sleep in hotels, and the inconvenience.
Your Honor, you said and you stated that the court has received, I think, 466 cases since 2003. You cited also the lack of enforcement and compliance with the court's judgments. Some of the high-profile human rights abuses cases brought to the court, if I'm not mistaken, have been against governments. What do you think can be done and should be done to give teeth to the enforcement mechanism of your judgments?
Thank you very much for this question. Actually, on the status quo is that countries should appoint focal persons within their own countries, and mostly the Attorney General's Office or Solicitor General's Office, to receive the orders and judgments of the court and make sure they enforce them. If it's about compensation or restitution, any orders, they didn't see to it that they are enforced. But then those people work for government. Therefore, we are suggesting that our judgments automatically, once you file it within the country, there should be a legislation so that you can go and file it within the local jurisdiction of the court. And once you file it, it becomes a judgment just as enforceable as any local judgment which you can enforce.
You listed a number of challenges facing the court. So what do you think West African leaders can do to help the court better overcome some of its challenges?
I think resourcing the courts. As it is now, as you know, three official languages in this court. And therefore, at any point in time, there should be translation of all the court processes into the other two languages. For instance, if someone files a process in English, there should be translation into Portuguese for Quebec and the Guinea-Bissau judges, and then into French for the other French people. Now, just for lack of staff in that respect, we are trying to use freelancers, which is extremely bad for the court. Look at how confidential court processes are. So, resourcing the court, as you said, we need not less than about 12 translators, three for each of the languages and one each as revisers, so they can revise the translated versions to see that they are in tandem with the original language in which the case was filed. In the same way, sustenance of this virtual court hearing is an IT issue. So bad, we have only three IT guys in this court. And therefore, for the virtual system to work and work perfectly, we need about three more IT staff, which I've also told them about.
Justice Samuel Cole Asante, it's so nice to talk with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. You're always available. Thank you very much.
Justice Edward Moako Asante is the president of the ECOWAS Community Court of Justice. You're speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. Malawi's ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, has accused the opposition Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, of intimidating its supporters during Tuesday's voting. DPP spokesperson Nicholas Dawusi says the move is tantamount to rigging the election, as it forced many DPP election monitors away from polling centers. But as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, MCP officials have denied the allegations.
At a press conference on Wednesday, Democratic Progressive Party spokesman Nicholas Dawusi showed reporters photographs of some DPP supporters who he said were assaulted by thugs sent by the opposition Malawi Congress Party.
As you are talking, Democratic Progressive Party monitors in the areas of Kabudula, Lilongwe, Mapuyu North, and Lilongwe, Kasia were abducted. Up to now, four girls and four boys are missing.
He said that MCP members also manhandled DPP Secretary General Griselda Jeffrey and burglarized the home of her husband.
The thugs went to his house, they damaged the government vehicle, and they stole almost 11 million, which was meant for DPP monitors in Salima.
Maurice Muntari is the spokesperson for the opposition MCP. He told VOA Wednesday via telephone that what the DPP is saying is laughable because there is no evidence that those attackers were members of the Malawi Congress Party.
If anything, what we have heard as Tons Alliance and Malawi Congress Party is that DPP was on it again, trying to rig the elections. DPP, if anything, would not have expected Malawians to sit idle and watch such nasty things happening around them.
MCP candidate Lazarus Chakwera is the main challenger to President and DPP candidate Peter Mutharika in the election. The poll was a rerun of last year's election won by President Mutharika, but annulled by Malawi's Constitutional Court because of massive irregularities. At a press conference Wednesday, MEC Chairperson Chifundo Kachale said the commission had received a total of four complaints from both the MCP and DPP parties alleging intimidation during the voting process. Kachale said the commission will ensure that all the complaints are amicably addressed before an announcement of final election results within 8 days. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
African leaders and health experts have called for equitable and fair access to any approved vaccine against the coronavirus, as the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in Africa has grown to over 321,000. Governments across the continent are organizing themselves to manufacture any vaccine quickly. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said Wednesday that huge investment was needed for any approved COVID-19 vaccine to be quickly made available throughout Africa.
Only one virus in history has been eradicated. It's likely that COVID-19 will be with us for the foreseeable future, and we must learn to live with it. A vaccine will be an essential tool for doing that.
He was speaking at a conference in Addis Ababa, organized by the African Union and the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Africa is seeing increasing numbers of confirmed infections as testing on Tuesday became available in every country on the continent. The WHO on Wednesday said Africa had over 321,000 confirmed infections. African leaders and health experts attending the conference said the continent's most vulnerable and health workers would need a vaccine soonest. Director of the Africa CDC, Dr. John Nkangasong, said countries should be preparing.
As a continent, we should be positioning ourselves to conduct clinical trials across the continent in a network fashion. We should also enable regulatory processes that will facilitate uptake of vaccines. We also need to secure deals through bilateral governments.
South Africa, the African country worst hit by the virus with over 100,000 confirmed infections, on Tuesday reported its highest daily death toll, 111 people since the pandemic began. Salim Abdul Karim is chair of the South African Ministerial Advisory Committee for COVID-19. He said countries would need to deal with intellectual property issues to move quickly to manufacture a vaccine.
Most of the companies that are developing vaccines are developing it basically with a twofold market strategy. The first is to have a profitable market in the wealthy countries, and then to have a voluntary license market in the countries that will not be able to afford purchasing the vaccine. In terms of countries that can't afford the vaccine, the voluntary licensing will enable, you know, big manufacturers in India and China to manufacture it under license, and then they would supply it to various countries.
Karim said that the world's poorest countries would likely be covered through Gavi, a global vaccine alliance spearheaded by the United Nations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He said that developing countries, such as South Africa, would likely purchase vaccines at a fraction of the cost. Meanwhile, African countries are responding to the pandemic, but there are gaps with providing safety equipment and inconsistent measures to stop the virus that still make the continent vulnerable. WHO Director General Ghebreyesus said the pandemic is now accelerating at an alarming rate globally, and while it took more than 3 months for the virus to infect 1 million people, the last 1 million cases were reported in just 1 week. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Patti in Washington. Today is Thursday, June 25th. President Cyril Ramaphosa says violence against girls and women is South Africa's second pandemic. The nation has one of the world's highest rates of rape and femicide, and several recent, especially brutal killings have enraged the public. But activists say they need to see real change, not just words from leaders, to protect victims. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to girls and women who have survived the violence and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
Like a lot of teenagers, Tembekile Tlea dreams big. But since she was raped earlier this year by a man in her slum-like neighborhood in Johannesburg, this 13-year-old's dreams have turned dark.
I want to be a sound engineer and a lawyer. Yeah, but whilst I'm thinking about that, there are times when, like, I feel like my dreams are shattered. I just feel like my dreams are shattered. Nothing will be good for me again.
She's one of countless South African girls and women who fall prey every day to what President Cyril Ramaphosa described as a war of gender-based violence.
As a man, as a husband, and as a father to daughters, I am appalled at what is no less than a war that is being waged against the women and the children of our country.
Police murder statistics show that a woman is killed every 3 hours. Official statistics on sexual assault may not show the full scope of the problem, researchers say, because many victims don't report the incident to police. Given Sikakwe, who works with nonprofit organization Sonke Gender Justice, says patriarchy, the belief that men rule in the family and society, is the main culprit. He praised Ramaphosa for his strong words, but said that it's the seemingly innocent ones that cause problems.
A lot of comments, for example, that are made in the home seem quite innocuous. But there's nothing innocuous if you're operating in a system like patriarchy, where to show your strength, you need to beat up someone. I'm particularly worried about the seemingly harmless behavior that we promote in our homes, because that, for me, we are indirectly forming ticking time bombs.
17-year-old Aquiline Shaku says she's seen how words can hurt.
Like last week, when my dad came home, I don't know what happened. So he started shouting at my mom and like swearing at her. So I went out and cried because I didn't think it was something that could happen to me. I thought, like, not at first, I thought that gender-based violence is about physical abuse only. But then when I realized how my mom has been emotionally abused, it broke me apart, because now she's like part of that struggle of trying to fight to get out of that kind of relationship, but my dad doesn't allow her to go.
Activist Tokozani Ndaba founded an organization for girls in an impoverished part of northern Johannesburg. She says that while women and girls of all backgrounds are affected by gender-based violence, she started this program here because it's particularly lacking in resources.
There was an 11-year-old who was raped in 2018, and she gave birth to an HIV-positive child, and she was positive. And in 2018, how is that possible? So this is how the program started. We have an after-school program where after school they can come here, because the only thing that's around is, saw all those men drinking at 10 in the morning. There's nothing, there's no hope. It's a dire situation, and all they know is grab the young people that they see around and rape them and destroy their lives, because their lives are already destroyed.
Ndaba, like many activists, is calling for harsher penalties for sexual assault. Tembekile agrees. She recently learned, when she saw him on the street, that the man who raped her was released on bail. That provoked a tailspin of emotions.
Do you think you should go to jail for a long time?
Yes, I think so, because, like there are a lot of girls, there are a lot of women in this area. Why didn't she go to some woman then to come to me? Like, there are a lot of girls and women, like, who he could be in the relationship with them, not to come and rape me.
But these young women say they will not let their assailants redefine their lives or their dreams.
Now I'm a girl. Now I'm a girl. I'm a girl who is a gold, not a stone, a diamond. And you
know, thank you. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Sickle cell patients in Cameroon on this year's World Sickle Cell Day on June 19 asked to be given additional care and support. They said the genetic disorder, primarily seen in people of African descent, puts them more at risk for COVID-19. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
About 200 sickle cell patients visited hospitals and the Cameroon Red Cross office in the capital Yaoundé Friday to complain that they were being sidelined in efforts to stop the spread of the coronavirus in the Central African state. 40-year-old Jeroni Makite, father of two children living with the disease, says he expects the government to provide face masks and hand sanitizers free of charge and to ask hospitals to give preferential treatment to sickle cell patients when they visit. He says he has come out on World Sickle Cell Day to ask the government to pay more attention to its citizens who are living with the genetic disorder and are more likely to have severe complications and die if they are infected with COVID-19. He says he believes that one of his two sons living with sickle cell contracted COVID-19 at the hospital he took the child to for regular health care. Makiti said his family was ostracized by his neighbors after information that his son tested COVID-19 positive leaked. He said the stigma from COVID-19 combined with age-old superstitious beliefs that sickle cell is divine punishment for wrongdoing and that children with the disease are mysterious was making life very difficult for his family. Cameroon's health ministry says sickle cell patients already have respiratory difficulties, which may be very complicated and difficult to handle should they be infected with COVID-19. It says people living with blood disorders, such as sickle cell disease, have an increased risk of developing serious COVID-19 symptoms and recommends that they should stock up on essential medicines and supplies that can last for several weeks. Laurentine Mandeng of the Cameroon Association of Young Sickle Cell Patients says most sickle cell patients in Cameroon are poor and cannot raise money to buy COVID-19 protection kits.
Le don est destiné aux associations.
Mandeng says only the Cameroon Red Cross has been able to assist them with face masks and hand sanitizers. She says she asks that the supplies should be sent to associations of sickle cell patients and specialized hospitals that take care of people living with the genetic disorder because she does not want sickle cell patients to be infected with COVID-19 when they visit regular hospitals. Cameroon Health Minister Manauda Malashi says sickle cell patients like other Cameroonians will be given free face masks, buckets and soap, and hand sanitizers to protect themselves from the coronavirus.
Le constat sur le terrain, c'est que en même temps que nous avons quand même une bonne
Manauda says he has observed that some sickle cell patients, just like many other Cameroonians, are refusing to obey barrier measures like keeping a distance of at least a meter and a half from each other, washing hands regularly, or using hand sanitizers and wearing face masks. He says for Cameroon to be saved from the killer virus, all its citizens, including sickle cell patients, must observe measures the government has put in place to stop COVID-19. Cameroon says the prevalence of sickle cell is 20% among its 25 million population. Sickle cell is an inherited red blood cell disorder in which there aren't enough healthy red blood cells to carry oxygen throughout the body of patients. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Despite churches in Nigeria emerging from lockdown to once again hold weddings, they are trying to cut down on the number of guests. The ongoing coronavirus pandemic has led many couples to get married online through video conferencing platforms. But Nigeria's large wedding industry, which is geared towards entertaining large number of guests, is struggling to adjust to the new reality. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Excitement in the air as newly married Matthew and Peace Udokomusi march out of the church auditorium of the Family Worship Center in Abuja City. The wedding, initially scheduled for April, was held 2 months later under strict COVID-19 guidelines, say the couple.
My family is very large. I have my elder sisters in Lagos, my brother, all of them. Those they can't come. Those in Lagos couldn't come. My two sisters in Bokoja, she couldn't come presently. It would have been so big.
I have told myself I was going to entertain the public with dance. And in fact, that is the only thing I am regretting, because there is no music, there is nothing.
Most Nigerian churches reopened earlier this month after authorities lifted the ban on religious gatherings. But most churches are treading carefully. During Peace and Matthew's wedding, only 15 people, including the couple and officiating pastors, were allowed into the 3,500-capacity church auditorium. Guests, including family members and friends, witnessed the occasion streaming online from their homes, with some, such as Dennis Dogo, just outside the church premises.
From the gate, we were stopped. But while outside, we connected via online. There was a live Facebook program going on, which we view the wedding from outside. So basically, we were not totally disconnected.
The wedding industry is big business in Nigeria, but the coronavirus pandemic is changing how companies within the industry operate. Event planners such as Victor Nyekwere say the pandemic impacted their revenues. The good thing about online weddings, says Victor, is that it gives an option for couples to get married and move ahead with their lives. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that's it for this Thursday, June 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clote.
host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live.